This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. The legendary power pop band Fountains of Wayne will be here later in the hour. They'll help us ease into the weekend with songs from their new album, Sky Full of Holes.
But first, what a week it has been. The economy feels full of holes, as does President Obama's handling of it, at least according to GOP presidential contenders in last night's debate in Iowa.
Look, I'm not going to eat Barack Obama's dog food, all right? What he served up was not what I would have done if I'd have been president of the United States.
Also not popular, Washington, according to Elizabeth Warren.
You know, I'm not a Washington person. I never really wanted a job here.
Well, actually, that was last year's Elizabeth Warren. This year's Elizabeth Warren might actually just want a Washington job anyway, specifically in the U.S. Senate.
Also this week, Democrats appointed Senator John Kerry to the so-called super committee charged with reducing the U.S. deficit.
What we need is a Washington that stops this bickering.
And this week, we learned as much as $30 million in Massachusetts special education funds may have been misspent on things like alcohol, country clubs, and sky-high salaries. So joining us now to dig through the week that was is Boston Globe columnist Jeff Jacoby. Hey there, Jeff.
Hello, Meghna. How are you?
I'm doing very well. And also with us today is Pulitzer Prize-winning independent journalist Ken Cooper. Hi there, Ken.
Hello there, Meghna.
So let's start right off with last night's GOP debate in Iowa, a roundtable it was called. After a week of the stock market going up and down and up and down, economic unrest, obviously, it's not that much of a surprise that the economy was one of the major focuses in the debate. So here's a little bit of tape of Minnesota Representative Michelle Bachmann and former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney and former Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty from last night.
Number one, we should not have increased the debt ceiling.
We're inches away from no longer having a free economy.
Where's Barack Obama on these issues? You can't find his plans on some of the most pressing financial issues of our country.
So, Jeff, let me start with you. Variations on a theme. Do you think that anyone sort of pulled ahead based on their performances of last night?
I want to go back to Barack Obama's dog food. I think there's going to have to be a cookbook when all this is said and done. Last night in the debate, Tim Pawlenty was saying that if anybody could find the details that Barack Obama was providing, he would come over to your house and cook your breakfast and mow your lawn. So we're going to have to get the dog food. From earlier in Washington, we had the sugar-coated Satan sandwich, all kinds of culinary aspects to politics this year. Was there one clear winner? I don't think so. I don't think there was a clear loser either. Mitt Romney went in as the sort of front runner, the sort of establishment candidate, and I think he came out continuing to stand tall. That interesting byplay between Michelle Bachmann and Tim Pawlenty, the two Minnesota would-be presidents mm-hmm. who weren't playing Minnesota nice last night. Clearly, they both realize that they've got a lot riding in the Ames poll this weekend.
Oh, the straw poll, exactly.
The straw poll in Ames, Iowa this weekend. And it's, I guess, the conventional wisdom is one of them will be killed by the results of that poll unless somehow they both tie for first place. An interesting debate. There was a lot of stuff that took place. It lasted for 2 hours. You know, some interesting questions, some interesting answers, and I don't think there were any really terrible performances.
Well, I want to hear a little bit more of the debate, but first, Ken, let me get your thoughts on what happened last night.
Yeah, I largely agree with Jeff on that. That it doesn't really change the field at all. Romney, I would call him the presumptive front runner.
That's a good word.
He remains that, even though nobody's really voted just yet. I think he will have to develop a strategy because he's not going to get a pass forever. Then when the other candidates start throwing barbs at him, I think he'll have to develop a strategy on for how
or when
he responds.
I mean, very, very soon, Texas Governor Rick Perry is going to enter the race, and he's expected to really shake things up and be one of the most viable contenders against Romney.
I think that's true. I mean, much as people say about polls and Romney leading, I have a hard time believing that he will actually prevail in a party whose base is in the South. And Governor Rick Perry, like a previous governor of Texas that we all got to know pretty well, can talk Southern to those Southern Republicans. And right now, the only one in the field who can do that is Herm Cain. So I think Rick Perry will be a challenge to Mitt Romney. I think in the general electorate, already the Democrats have already said, hey, another Texas governor, see how well the last one turned out. So, you know, I think I
think all of that's going to be part of the mix, but I would say that there's probably going to be more to the Rick Perry phenomenon than simply the fact that he can talk Southern to Southern Republicans. It is certainly true that the social conservative wing of the Republican Party, the Christian conservative wing, is one that he represents and fits perfectly. He had this big prayer rally that he personally led just this past week. But there's also the economic growth wing, and Texas is just on fire economically.
Right, and many people say he's the one who bridges those two wings.
Something like, I forget exactly what the numbers, but more than half of all the jobs created in America in the past 2 years have been created in Texas. You're running for governor in a time of an economic downturn. Those aren't bad numbers to be able to point to.
Makes you wonder why he wants to leave Texas. You mentioned earlier about a dearth of Minnesota nice. I want to play a little bit more tape of between those two Minnesotans, former Governor Tim Pawlenty and current Representative Michelle Bachmann. Well, here's a little tit for tat between them.
She fought for less government spending. We got a lot more. She led the effort against Obamacare. We got Obamacare. She led the effort against TARP. We got TARP. She said she's got a titanium spine. It's not her spine we're worried about. It's her record of results. If that's your view of effective leadership with results, please stop, because you're killing us.
All right. Wait. Congressman Bachmann, 30 seconds to respond.
Thank you so much. I was at the tip of the spear fighting against the implementation of Obamacare in the United States Congress.
So,
you know something? You listen to her answers to virtually every question, and the subtext of her answer is, I will fight for you. And it's true, Pawlenty came up with a theme to try to go after her with, you know, yeah, you're a fighter, but you don't win. I think these days a lot of liberal Democrats are saying that about Barack Obama as well. There's something to be said for it's not enough just to, you know, just to be feisty, to be willing to mix it up. You've got to be able to accomplish. But in a primary field this big, mm-hmm. and against a candidate that they're all looking down the road to competing against, to be able to say, as Michelle Bachmann does, with such fervor and such conviction, I will fight for you, and to have 1,000 different ways of saying it, I think that says something about her and about her appeal.
And that does seem to be one of the things that's resonating, with Iowa voters. Many people think she might do very well in the straw poll on Saturday. But Ken, before we leave the topic of last night's debate, I mean, I want to take it back to Governor Romney for a moment. Apparently earlier in the day, when he was at an appearance at the Iowa State Fair, he was actually badgered by some hecklers in the audience. And they were chanting about corporations. And Governor Romney, I don't know if he let slip or maybe, you know, it's a Freudian slip of some kind, but he actually ended up saying corporations are people. Now, a lot of Democrats think, well, they're probably most likely going to use this as a quote-unquote defining moment of the early days of his campaign.
Yeah, I don't doubt that the Democrats will use that against him, although the governor is actually correct in the legal sense that corporations have the status as individuals, and corporate refers from the Latin for body. And he also further explained that he meant that people work for corporations. And people are invested in corporations, so when they make money, people benefit. But it's the kind of thing that, you know, particularly real liberal Democrats will use to bash him.
Yeah, you'll take that 3-second little clip and play it out of context, and it sounds like he's saying something he really wasn't. He was simply saying money that corporations make eventually ends up in the pockets of people.
But here's my question. I mean, Jeff, as you were just saying, Michelle Bachmann has 1,000 different ways of saying, I will fight for you, you know, the average American. Governor Romney has run multiplicity of campaigns. He ought to know better that in an economy like this, to even say something that can be reduced down to corporations are people, it can be kind of deadly.
I would say he probably got rattled a little bit. He's used to, especially at the Iowa State Fair, where the people who are there sitting on the hay bales listening to the Republican candidates are usually very polite. And there were people from the other side of the political aisle wanting to mix it up with him. You know, good for him for getting into the fight. But as you say, when you're running for president, when you're at that level, when the media is following you in a horde wherever you go, you've got to be careful about every single phrase that comes out of your mouth.
Well, you know, thinking again about your food metaphor, let us not forget the pork chop on a stick that the governor ate at the Iowa State Fair.
I listened to the story on NPR this morning, and Don Gagne was there eating, if I have this right, deep-fried butter.
Mm. On a stick.
They were served, I don't know if it was on a stick, but deep-fried butter at the Iowa State Fair. You know, I'm a proud Midwesterner. I grew up in Ohio, but I don't know about that.
Anyway, let's leave the GOP candidates to their straw poll on Saturday and move on to the so-called super committee in charge of finding ways to cut the federal budget. Senator John Kerry was appointed to that team of 12 lawmakers. We heard him a little bit earlier in the show saying it's time for Washington to stop bickering. Here's a little bit more of what he's had to say.
I believe this is, without question, the Tea Party downgrade. This is the Tea Party downgrade because a minority of people in the House of Representatives countered even the will of many Republicans in the United States Senate.
Okay, so Tea Party downgrade seems to be a Democratic talking point.
You think?
That was Kerry on Sunday. A couple channels over on Face the Nation, President Barack Obama's campaign strategist David Axelrod said this.
The fact of the matter is that this is essentially a Tea Party downgrade.
Okay.
He thought of it on his own. I'm sure he did.
Ken, your thoughts?
Well, it's not the most politic thing for him to say as he enters a negotiation with such large stakes. That said, I think the Senator Kerry's appointment is a good one. He's a senior Democrat. He's a former presidential nominee. He has stature. And he is a senior senator at this point who has grown up in a Senate where actually members of the different parties in the past have made deals to solve big problems. And I think he's of that tradition. So I think he's a good addition.
Hmm. Jeff.
I actually thought that even more noteworthy than John Kerry showing he can read the Democratic Party MoveOn.org talking points was something else that he said. On the day that the downgrade was announced by the S&P, he basically called on the media to stop covering the Tea Party Republicans and their message. He basically said, you've got to stop thinking that they deserve equal time, that there should be equal coverage of what they have to say. And, I got to tell you, I believe in feisty politics. I believe in, people battling over important issues. And I think that we're engaged in this country right now in a big debate over some fundamental questions. But when somebody of John Kerry's, I almost hate to use the word stature, but when somebody who's been in government as long as John Kerry has, somebody, as Ken points out, who ran for president as the nominee of his party, basically tells the media, blackball one whole side of this debate. There's something wrong with that. So I'm not actually expecting great things out of John Kerry on the super committee. I hope he'll rise above my expectations and surprise me. But
well, for a question for both of you, what about your expectations of the committee itself? I mean, it seems as if though the 12 who are appointed, the current common wisdom is that they are quite a bit a reflection of the leadership in either party, and it's that same leadership that was basically unable to come to any sort of compromise to begin with.
Yeah, that's true. I think that I would make one sort of quibble with that description of the committee. I am quite surprised, actually, that Mitch McConnell, the Senate Republican leader, appointed two freshman Republicans to a committee like this, Pat Toomey and Rob Portman. They're both freshman senators from Ohio, Portman, and Toomey from Pennsylvania. And I think that's a concession to the Tea Party. And it's interesting that in the House, which is where Speaker Boehner was driven by the Tea Party to do some things during the negotiations, that he appointed senior Republicans who are leadership rank Republicans and not any of the freshmen.
Yeah, I would disagree with that. I don't think that there was any kind of failure to take it seriously. Toomey is you're certainly right. Toomey is very much a Tea Party favorite, former head of the Club for Growth, former representative from Pennsylvania as well, very strongly respected by fiscal conservatives. Portman was a budget director, right? Wasn't he the head of the OMB, the Office Management and Budget, I think, in the Bush administration. Mm-hmm. So, again, there's a lot of stature there when it comes to dealing with fiscal issues. To repeat a point made before, there's this big debate taking place in this country. And the gamut that these guys, spread from one end of the spectrum all the way to the other reflects some of that. I don't think you're going to see, the millennium brought on by the committee, but they've got to do something. There's a law written that says if they can't come to an action, to a decision, there's going to be a whole bunch of triggers that nobody's going to like. So I think one way or another, they're going to force themselves to come up with something.
Well, we will know by November 23rd, because that's their first deadline on coming up with a plan. Now, before we run out of too much time, I do want to bring up one last topic, and that is, of course, Elizabeth Warren and the possibility, seemingly increasing possibility, that she will jump into the 2012 Senate race here in Massachusetts. Here's a little bit of tape of her talking to MSNBC's Rachel Maddow last month after it was clear that President Barack Obama would not choose her to lead the agency that she founded, the Consumer Financial Protection Agency.
I have really done three things in my life. I have taught school because that's what I do. I've done research around what happens to middle-class families and tried to understand that. And I have thrown rocks at people that I think are in the wrong. I've done it before, I've continued to do it, and I'm going to do it in the future.
So then she writes this week a letter to Blue Mass Group, the Democratic Progressive Group here in Massachusetts, saying, I've left Washington, but I don't plan to stop fighting for middle-class families. Jeff.
Sounds like a candidate who's gearing up for an announcement to me. And then you read the stories in the paper today about all the people that she's lining up to work for her, all the phone calls that she was making in the past 48 hours to let Democratic Party officials know, you know, that these are her plans. It seems very clear. If she's not 100% committed, I'd say she's about 98% of the way there.
Well, on that note, she's already receiving some criticism from the Massachusetts Republican Party. I mean, Jennifer Nassour, chairman of the Massachusetts GOP, said, it's ironic that a so-called consumer champion like Professor Warren is already taking her marching orders from two well-connected Beacon Hill lobbyists. Those are the advisors, Jeff, that you mentioned mm-hmm. that she's been said to have hired. Doug Rubin is officially the only one who's actually registered as a lobbyist here in Massachusetts. So, Ken, I mean, this pushback from the Massachusetts GOP, do you see that as evidence of Elizabeth Warren's potential, you know, strength as a candidate or possibly naivete about how a political campaign is run?
Well, the first thing I think about without even reference to what the Republican chairman said is that, you know, she's a first-time candidate, and generally campaigns are won by whoever runs the best campaign. So I think she's got a lot of hurdles, no matter how popular she might be with certain quarters of the Democratic Party and Democrats at large here in Massachusetts. She's up against two other candidates in the Democratic primary, Bob Massey and Alan Kaze, who have both run statewide before. She's never been a candidate for office. She didn't even get a chance to actually make her case for the nomination down in Washington before Kitty. So I think there are questions about her level of political skill and her level of ability as a campaigner.
Well, we will see what move she makes next. And the move we're going to make right now is to our hubbubs. And that's the story that didn't necessarily rise to the top of this list, but piqued our interest anyway. Anthony, you're first.
Okay, so my hubbub comes from the New York Times today, from below the fold. It turns out that for the past 15 years, the fancy Manhattan food store Zabar's has been selling lobster salad that, surprise, surprise, has lacked a key ingredient. Lobster salad, guess what it has lacked?
Salad.
Lobster.
Oh.
Lobster.
Oh.
That would have been my second guess. No lobster in the lobster salad at Zabar's. So how did this come about? So a guy named Doug McCash, according to the Times, he's a reporter from the Times-Picayune of New Orleans, was in New York. He ordered the lobster salad. He thought it tasted great, but he thought, you know, this tastes familiar. It tastes kind of like crawfish that I eat back home in Louisiana. And in fact, that's what's in the lobster salad in Zabar's. It's crawfish. And all this caught the attention of our friends up north at the Maine Lobster Council. They called Zabar's to complain. And 83-year-old Saul Zabar, the owner of Zabar's, said they weren't misrepresenting the ingredients because crawfish are related to lobster. I didn't know that. The New York Times points out, sort of, in the same way that minnows are related to trout. But anyway.
Was there any deep fried butter?
Apparently not. But they put all this crawfish confusion to rest. Zabar has relabeled their lobster salad as seafarer salad. But, of course, crawfish are freshwater fish. They're not really from the sea, so I think you still got a problem.
What I want to know is why all those refined palates in New York couldn't tell the difference. It took someone from Louisiana to nail it down as crawfish. Anyway, Ken, your hubbub.
Yeah, I'm just returning, as you know, from a stay in my hometown, which is Denver, Colorado. It's a city with a population that's 10% black and has recently elected its second African-American mayor. Michael Hancock is a former city councilman who has lifted himself up from a public housing project as a child. He built a broad coalition to win the election, and it wasn't a typical progressive Democratic coalition. He's more of a pro-business Democrat.
Hmm. Excellent. Jeff, your hubbub.
Not nearly as serious, but
as no lobster in the lobster salad? Come on, you can beat that.
It is another food-related.
All right, good.
McAllen, Texas, Appleton, Wisconsin, Midway, Georgia, Hazelwood, Missouri, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Naples, Florida, Rio Nido, California. There have been case after case after case this summer of little kids' lemonade stands being shut down by local officials in one town after another around the country. Obviously, none of these stories ever becomes a big above the fold kind of thing. But when you look at the long list of all these cases, it's really shocking.
And the reasons
they shut down these lemonade stands being run by 4 and 5 year olds because they didn't get a health permit or they didn't have an inspection by the inspectional services department, or they don't have a peddler's license or they don't have a business plan that's supposed to be filed. So a group of activists have launched what they're calling Lemonade Freedom Day, which is August 20. And I guess the idea is you're supposed to support your local little kid selling lemonade. For those of us like me who are on the right side of the political spectrum, this is just more evidence that, the long arm of the government often goes way, way farther than it should. But I would like to think that even for my friends on the left side of the spectrum, when you see 4-year-olds being reduced to tears because the man is shutting down their lemonade stand, even then you ought to be able to say the era of government this big ought to be over.
I think we can unite the country around lemonade.
Lemonade freedom. And then the crawfish salad.
And small businesses are supposed to be the job-creating engine in the United
Apparently
States.
Apparently not
it's
in Hazelwood,
Texas.
Keeping
4-year-olds busy. Well, on that note, that's all we've got time for today. Jeff Jacoby, columnist for the Boston Globe, thank you so much.
Thank you, Meghna.
And Ken Cooper, Pulitzer Prize-winning independent journalist, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Meghna.
Well, stay with us because up next, your feedback about some of our recent programs, and a little later in the show, Fountains of Wayne, live in the studio. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.